This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today we're talking to the legendary Greg Smith, the author of Paper Safe, which is becoming kind of like a must read for every safety professional. Let's jump into the intro. I'll tell you some more about it. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety does exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to change the perception. We do that right here at YouTube and podcast. So if you're new, hit subscribe, bell, bloody blah, all of that stuff. Rebranding Safety is brought to you by us, Risk Fluent, the consultancy that's always been sitting behind Rebranding Safety, but has now, since of 2022, gone full-time. We offer a technical side of health, safety, fire safety, that traditional technical management of health and safety. We offer all of that stuff as a kind of normal consultant, essentially, but we also offer our transformational services as well, around culture change, human error awareness, behavioral kind of safety stuff, and all of that stuff, trying to bring those two worlds together. So if you need any kind of support, be it technical or transformational, then please let us know. But you can find out some more at riskfluentlimited.com. You'll start seeing the Rebranding Safety stuff come over onto Risk Fluent as well, as the Risk Fluent brand is now fully there and we can start bringing all of that stuff under one house, one brand. So keep your eye out for that stuff as well. But ultimately, I look forward to hearing from you. Let's have a quick chat about today's episode then. So the legendary Greg Smith has come on the podcast. Been a while trying to get Greg on this podcast, actually. Not for anyone's fault, not the fact they didn't want to come on. It was just getting times and dates when each of us are on different sides of the entire planet is a challenge. But ultimately, I hope you've read that amazing, I'm pretty much kind of talisman of a book within safety called Paper Safe. If you haven't, you will definitely want to read it after today's episode. And if you haven't, where have you been? Such a good book and something that I think every safety professional needs to talk about. We kind of touch on Paper Safe a bit, but we really just have a kind of a real broad chat, but then also quite narrow in scope in around like the legal side of things, reasonably practicable, understanding case studies, the paper, the safety paradox that he said in the books. We touch on that a few times. We touch on the conversation that he had with David Provan over on the Safety of Work podcast. You haven't listened to that. That's really good as well. And it's a different type of conversation for what we're talking about. So we'll link that in the description below and you can have a listen to that. But otherwise, let's jump into our conversation with Greg Smith. I hope you enjoy it. Right, Greg, welcome to the podcast, buddy. Thank you for coming on.
Not at all, James. Thanks. It's taken a while to get all of our ducks in a row, but here we are.
That's one of the hardest bloody things, if I'm honest, is getting everyone's diaries aligned. And then when you start involving bloody time differences and everything, it's painful. It's painful. Wow. But yeah, everyone's so busy, like everywhere. The entire world seems to have just woken up after Grenfell and after Grenfell. I'm not with it today. After COVID and and just everyone. I don't speak to anyone at the moment that goes, actually, I'm not very busy. I'm quite quiet. Everyone is rammed. Everyone, which is good.
Yeah, up to a point.
Yeah.
Busy in there is ridiculous.
Good problems to have, but problems nonetheless. Ultimately. Hey. We don't want to be quiet, but still, yeah, everything comes with a trade-off. Right, Greg, in case anybody doesn't know who you are, do you want to give yourself a little introduction and then we're going to have a bit of a chat around Paper Safe and some of the newer work that you're kind of working on, just a general chit-chat around all of that stuff and see where the convo takes us.
Thanks, James. I'm an Australian-based lawyer. So apologies probably for both of those things. we'll see where that takes us. Specialising primarily in workplace health and safety. Initially started more than 30 years ago now in the law, started in the employment area. Back when safety wasn't really an area of law or not of any significance to anybody. You couldn't study it at university when I was at university then, so it's a sort of a new thing in that sense. And found my way into workplace health and safety through employment law. But I've cycled through a few different things. So I was a qualified lawyer, then I went and joined the army for a while and was a lawyer in the army, came out back into the law, went out and took up an operational safety role in the oil and gas industry, just to try and get a bit of an operational sense of all this stuff I'm talking about in theory. What does it look like in practice?
Mm-hmm.
Which was an interesting experience. Back into the law, I lectured and taught at one of the local universities here in Western Australia for a while, which sort of really got my academic juices going. Went and worked for a mining services company for a little while as a general manager of health and safety, again, just to try and test and experiment with some ideas, and now back in the law, nice. Practicing as a lawyer and a quasi-safety consultant, I think.
Quasi-safety consultant.
Well, I think that's kind of what I am. I'm a qualified safety and health auditor, but I mean primarily known for my work in health and safety law, and probably for a few of my books now that I've written a few.
Yeah. And Paper Safe was probably, it's definitely the biggest one of, it's one of the bigger books, I think, within kind of more, let's say, impactful safety management instead of giving it a label. But I think Paper Safe is one of the books that's in or should be in most people's bookcase if you're operating in safety. So I think that's a massive achievement, mate. That's a huge...
I find it interesting how that's landed, given that it's primarily written... Well, not primarily, I tried to avoid it, but basically underpinned by Australian legislative jurisdiction, or Australian legislation. It does draw on a lot of international inquiries as well. But it seems to have landed with a lot of people in a lot of different parts of the world who operate under different systems from Australia.
Yeah.
What I found interesting, I did a podcast with David Proven, who I think you've had previously.
Yep.
And we're talking about due diligence in the context of Australian jurisdiction, Australian legislation. And we were sort of fascinated about this confluence of events at around about 2018 when he was doing his work on safety clutter.
Yep.
And so he's over there doing that independently. Sydney Decker was doing his kind of safety anarchy and criticisms of rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that, now those criticisms of rules had always been around. And at the same time, I was sort of doing Paper Safe, not referencing each other in any way, shape, or form. And so it kind of said, well, you know, perhaps there is something underlying all of this, which is at the heart of safety that's concerning people.
Yeah. There is some, like, I kind of similarly talk to when I remember just being in like my first, second, maybe even third kind of safety job, and didn't even know this stuff existed, and genuinely thought, and like I joke about it a lot now, like genuinely thought I had the monopoly on a better way to do safety, because nobody was talking about kind of, hang on a minute, the all these papers and stuff not making any difference, you know, treating people like shit, and you know, they're always, you know, it's always their fault. It's not making any difference. And then just kind of started Rebranding Safety for that reason, to just kind of talk about it a little bit more and see if anyone else was interested. And then it turns out it's quite a lot of people around the world talking about this stuff, which was awesome, but then also quite disappointing, because I thought, well, I'm not gonna be a millionaire now because I don't have the monopoly on it. But in that time, I mean, Rebranded Safety has been going about just over 3 years. And I think when we started was not a lot of, well, she had like the big thinkers and talkers and that about like the more progressive move into more impactful safety and risk management. But ultimately the doers, the majority of the practitioners, the big bodies, particularly in the UK, were not entertaining this conversation at all. But then I'd say in the last year, maybe 2 years, there's been like another boost in it. Like, I couldn't put it down to anything. Like, I couldn't put it down to one thing. So it's weird that like you three kind of doing all that stuff at the same time, there must have been something there that kind of inspired all of you, or maybe there was like something subconscious there within the timing. And then again, I think something else happened about a year, maybe two ago, that there has been another boost, another kick up the butt for people to start going, you know, this stuff's not being that impactful.
Yeah. I think it's, I think there is certainly momentum behind that. And trying to make safety mean something in the workplace, and that's not even the right way to put it. I mean, safety does mean something in the workplace. You talk to operations people, and they care about safety, and they care about the people they work with. I think genuinely, and I haven't come up even some of the worst cases I've been involved in, some of the most egregious breaches of safety legislation. They're not being committed by people who don't care about safety. They might not have the skills or the wherewithal to understand the risks they're creating for people or to understand what they should be doing. But that's a very different thing from saying they don't care about safety.
Yeah.
But I think what people don't care about very much is safety management. Mm. They're not awfully fussed about the forms and the terribly written procedures.
Yeah.
And the incident investigations that don't go anywhere or don't change anything, all of that sort of shop floor frustration, I think, is what people genuinely don't care about. And I think even with all of the goodwill in the world, so the sort of the HOP type approaches and the learning team approaches and the humble inquiry approaches and all of the things that I think people are genuinely interested in about to humanise safety and to make those improvements, I still think it really struggles to cut through at a shop floor level.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the conversations we're having as a profession, I think, is better than what we were having even like 2-3 years ago, but, you know, probably like 5-10 years ago. It's better, 100%. It's nice to be talking a bit more. It's nice to be having, you know, more sociological, kind of psychological considerations within our conversations, human factors and all of that stuff, 100%. But ultimately, I think we still really struggle with what that looks like on the shop floor. I would totally agree. And that is probably the most messages that we get is, and the most people that we talk to, whether it's a small, medium sized business or a safety professional or whatever, you know, they're like, I've really loved all this stuff. I've been listening to your podcast. I've read this book. I've read that book. But like, what does it actually look like on the shop floor? And people really struggle with that, really still do struggle with that. Go on.
No, sorry, you finished. Sorry, James.
I was just going to say a couple of clients that we've been working for over the last couple of months have really pushed me on that exact problem, in that we've gone into one client that had all of those symptoms of kind of the people are the problem, or we just need to whip them a bit more. All the symptoms of that, like there was all like zero harm stuff, like the mirrors on the check-in bit, you know, this person's responsible. And it was like, oh God, this, here we go. But I'm like, okay, at least I know where I'm starting. But then the first thing that we did, it was me and a couple of other people that were working on this. We went into like the boardroom essentially and spoke to the senior leader for that site and the safety professional, and we're just talking to them, asking really broad open questions. And unprompted, out of nowhere, the leader, one of the I don't know, the head of the site or whatever, pretty senior role within the organization, said, look, James, I 100% know that my people don't come to work to do a bad job. I just want to help them do it. And I was like, well, fuck me. You could have took that out of Decker's book, out of Eric's book, Todd's book, you know, Greg's book, any of these books. But yet translating that onto the shop floor, they were just drowning them in paperwork. Because to your point, right, they felt like that was the way to do to keep them safer, because they do care and they want to keep them safe, but they struggle to work out what does that look like? You know, what does this more progressive way look like? And I think people still massively, massively struggle with that.
Yeah, and I think there's a few things at play there. I think, you know, the consulting industry, the insurance industry and the legal industry has got a bit to answer for with this emphasis on documentation. This whole idea has got to be written down, it's got to be proceduralized, and if something goes wrong, you add another step to the procedure. You know, that comes from a really uneducated, in terms of sociology and psychology and human factors and all of that, that comes from a really uneducated industry group that doesn't deal with that stuff very much. So I think there's some blame to go there. Oh, yeah. There you go, blame. So straight away the language that we don't want creeps into the conversation. I think the other problem is that all of these initiatives, even with the best will in the world, are really corruptible once they get onto the shop floor. Just, you know, in terms of I talk about, you know, the distinction between process and purpose, and I talk about the safety paradox in a lot of what I do. And you can take anything that is theoretically a good idea and you stick it into a work environment with people who aren't particularly interested in that kind of whatever your approach is, and it turns just into a process that people have got to tick their way through. You know, it's like, and I think that there's a bit to do there. I think the health and safety industry is a bit of an industry divided against itself. I think it always has been historically. I don't know why, but there seem to be really big egos in safety and everyone's convinced that they've got the right way to do things. But, you know, I find it interesting when you say, you know, you go into an organisation, you think, oh, they've got zero harm stuff up all over the place, and that's a warning sign for you. And then we have, I can't remember which body, I think it's the IOOF or one of them, but one of the peak industry safety body is all about vision zero. And we still, so we're an industry that's divided against itself. I don't, you know, we talk about, oh, it's difficult to understand what this looks like on the shop floor and what does it look like on the shop floor, James? We can't seem to get any agreement on that. You know, the fights between the safety one and safety two camps and, you know, are leading and lagging indicators, what do they look like? We just, the lack of agreement on any element on safety and how it ought to be managed as an industry, I think, is problematic. Even if we didn't have the perfect way to do something, but we all agreed on the way to do it and everyone was doing it the same way, that would probably take us a fair bit down the track. And the other thing, and you asked me before about my new books and things I'm writing, the other thing I'm distracted about at the moment is doing some work, because we've just had some new legislation introduced in Western Australia, which is modelled on the rest of the Australian jurisdiction. So at the time when we're trying to humanise safety and we're trying to give people more discretion in decision-making, we're trying to be more about learning and less about blame and all of those sorts of things, we seem to have this wave, and I think it's certainly in Australia, I think it's in most Commonwealth countries, it's probably global, but really heavy criminalisation of safety breaches. You know, industrial manslaughter, and we've had a couple of jail terms in Australia recently. And I think once, you know, most of what we see now in health and safety legislation is actually completely out of step with progressive thinking about how to actually manage health and safety in the work. We've got hundreds of pages of new regulations, which is completely out of step with, you know, the original intent of the Robins report back in the 70s, but it's actually prescribing different types of paperwork that we have to have. which is something we've been railing against, but the legislation now comes and says, no, you have to have paperwork, increasing individual accountability, increasing criminalisation. It's going to make it harder and harder for organisations to give discretion to their workforce because they're scared about accidents and prosecution, harder and harder to have conversations about safety, impossible to a large degree now to learn anything about safety. So we've got a new offence over here called Category 1, which attracts, any person can go to jail for 5 years for a breach of a Category 1 offence, including death and serious harm. So what that means, just as a small snapshot, is organisational attitudes to incident investigations are radically, and right before my eyes, they are radically altering. So whereas the lawyers would be called in when there was a fatality, it's like, well, Greg, do we need to get the lawyers in now if it's serious harm because this threat of imprisonment?
Mm.
And it's locked down. People aren't learning. They're not sharing. It's I think it's a huge problem.
That must change the emphasis behind it because you're now, that as that CEO, MD, whatever, you're in kind of naturally forced into self-preservation mode, aren't you? In that, or kind of self-defense mode in that I could go to jail now. Like nobody starts their company, you know what, we're really good at saying, you know, no one on the shop floor comes to do a bad job, right? I don't think we're very good at saying no MD starts a business to kill someone or to hurt someone. Like they're exactly the same. To your earlier point is that they do care and they think they're having an impact, but ultimately it's maybe not impacting as much as they thought they would. But also, when you get things like that in the conversation naturally by the legislation or by insurance is driven to the point of like you could genuinely go to jail or receive, you know, kind of negative implications. The main driver from that person to all subsequent kind of learnings, investigations, whatever you want to call it, would naturally be, or even if it's subconscious, would be self-preservation. Because I would go into self-preservation mode if I was like, shit, I could face 5 years in jail. And that's not just 5 years in jail, is it? Like, that's your entire life probably screwed. Once you come out of jail, like it comes with a bit of a brand.
When you look at the penalty provisions now in most modern, so-called modern safety legislation, the majority of medium-sized enterprises, for example, if they're prosecuted, that's it. That's the end of the business. They're going to be liquidated. The business won't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Now I understand it. Part of me has some empathy for what's driven this approach, and there are families and loved ones of people who have died at work who have genuinely suffered.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this in a pejorative sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're suffering from ignorance of what health and safety legislation is designed to do. Health and safety legislation was, even though it's criminal in nature, was never designed as a tool of retributive justice. It was designed to improve working conditions for people. And as far back again as the Robins Report, prosecution is the avenue of last resort.
Yeah, it's got goal-based legislation, isn't it? Like that's how I've always been taught it. It's goal-based, so it's like,
yeah,
you're aspiring to be as reasonable and practicable as possible, not avoiding punishment. It's that.
But the problem is all the messaging in the last 5 years has flipped completely on its head, yeah. And nobody in the business community sees the role of the health and safety regulator anymore as a sort of supportive or educative role.
Yeah,
it's a investigative and prosecutorial role.
Yeah,
The shift that I'm seeing in the sort of short term is not a shift based on improving health and safety outcomes. It's a shift based on legal risk management.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And, you know, the sort of, one of the sort of leading lights of that, if you like, where I think the legislation runs head on into conflict with what we would now say is good safety practice, is around the idea of enforcement of process. So we've got new positive due diligence obligations for our company offices over here. And one of the underpinning concepts around due diligence is the enforcement of the company's requirements.
Right.
And in the vast majority of cases, the enforcement of the company requirements translates into disciplinary action against the workforce.
Right, okay.
Which is one of the things that modern safety theory is trying to steer us all away from because it destroys learning.
Yeah.
So all of this stuff we've been talking about for years is this failure to learn on a micro level because of blame cultures and how that underpins successful safety outcomes. That's all the theories. That's what the research tells us. That's what the academics talk about. Is now starting to replicate and manifest itself at a macro level.
Mm.
So if we're, because it's seen as blame and retribution at a company level, the opportunities to learn are really diminishing really rapidly.
It's fascinating that, like, you kind of touched on it a minute ago when you said, like, you don't mean it kind of pejoratively and you don't mean to kind of essentially say something without having the empathy for the people that have been affected by an incident negatively, right? And that, you know, recently there's a lot of conversation you'd have probably picked it up on. There's loads of conversation over here because, you know, many years ago we had the Croydon tram crash, and recently they've just opened proceedings and the driver, the operator of the vehicle is up for prosecution within those proceedings as well. And then in America, you've got the nurse who's just been prosecuted. And then to your point, over in Australia, you've got this legislation coming as well. So these kind of three massive things going around the world going on that is kind of impactful against what we've been trying to push. And I know a couple of people that are working in the rail industry that are going through it and an introduction of like a just culture model. Like, we're trying to show that our aim is to learn and not blame and all of this stuff, right? And then bang, we're going to prosecute the tram driver. So like, that's a really difficult thing for them to deal with. But ultimately, like, my kind of difficulty with this is that it kind of, like, you know, when you get like a lot of people saying, oh, we're a no blame organization now, like, to me, that's just like the new view version of like zero harm. Like, it's not achievable to get no blame because the legislation does apply a level of accountability to it, because ultimately that always needs to be there, to your point, in that sometimes what you've done is so egregious or what you haven't done is so egregious that there does need to be a little bit of justice in that you do need to be ultimately punished. That's not the aim. It's the last, to your earlier point, it's the final step. We want to really try and go for that process. But I think, to, you know, and the reason I kind of brought up the tram example is because the family of the people that have passed or been injured in that event are on the news, and they're saying, finally, we feel like we're getting some accountability and justice. Like, and there's an emotional need there for that. So it needs to exist, doesn't it? Like, blame ultimately needs to exist, but probably not within the company. It needs to sit within the legal system or not. I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, the problem is, and to your point, I mean, the way I've heard it expressed over here is people saying, you know, we need to know that the life of our loved ones had some meaning.
Yeah, that,
you know, that's whatever it is.
Exactly what they've said.
I probably sound cold. I'm not trying to be cold. I haven't lost anyone that I love in a workplace accident, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If I did lose somebody in a workplace accident, I would probably feel the same. I would probably feel extraordinarily distressed and angry and want justice. Legitimate feelings, valid point of view. does not make me a good architect for health and safety legislation for all of those reasons. Okay. But to your point, James, in terms of a trade-off, you can't, I don't think you can isolate it. You can't say, yes, there needs to be a blame that sits at a corporate level. Because you can't, because as soon as you say at a corporate level, you are the entity that society is going to hold accountable for workplace accidents.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. Well, then the advice they're going to get straight away is to minimize your risk. Here is the enforcement action that you need to drive for your organization to make sure you've got workers who are being compliant and following your procedures. You can't isolate it. You can't. Everything in safety is a trade-off.
Yeah.
So if you want a system of retribution and prosecution, you need to recognize that there will be a trade-off for what that means for health and safety in our workplaces.
I love that.
And I think we've gotten the balance wrong. And it's interesting because one of the biggest misconceptions I find when dealing with the health and safety industry is that the idea that a health and safety prosecution is some sort of an inquiry to understand what went wrong. Mm. And it is not.
Mm.
The prosecution comes with a set of charges and a set of particulars to prove that charge, and that's all we are arguing about. So I did a case over here. It was only the second time a person in Australia had gone to had been sentenced to a term of imprisonment for a breach of health and safety legislation. So they ended up getting a two-year, two-month jail term, 8 months of which was served as a term of imprisonment, 18 months was suspended. And so it was a guilty, the fellow pleaded guilty and the company pleaded guilty. And the prosecutor, well, there was an agreed statement of facts and we argued over the particulars. And there's a line in the judgment from the magistrate where she said, neither the prosecution nor the defence could explain why the work was performed the way it was on the day.
Hmm.
So there was no inquiry into why the work was performed the way it was. So all this stuff we talk about, leadership and culture and behaviour and shaping factors and all of that, no relevance at all in the context of a prosecution. So it is not an opportunity to learn. So this is legislation that is designed retributively. It's prosecutions. It is not set up to create opportunities to learn and to improve safety.
So that's interesting when you like the main driver behind the education of safety professionals in the UK is legislation, I would say. You know, I think there's a lot of people out there that would disagree with me on that, but I think their disagreement would be wrong. And everything that we do is like, we have to do that because the manual handling regs say we have to do it, or the health and safety at work regs say that says we have to do it, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And I think whilst they all say we come to work to make sure everyone goes home the way, like everyone says that platitude, but ultimately like, I do question sometimes, like, what if we didn't have any legislation? If we just lost it tomorrow,
what would it look like?
Yeah, how would you do it? Because there are companies out there that don't even know that legislation exists, that don't understand it. They just crack on and they look at something like, I mean, this actually probably falls quite nicely onto some of the work you're working on at the minute around like, that kind of phrase reasonably practicable, right? That is perception based, like, and surely you can only define what's reasonable and practicable with hindsight. Can you ever define it? I would struggle to go to any safety professional, including myself, and say, define reasonably practicable. I don't think they really properly could. Like, what does that actually look like? It's just different to all the time. But yet, that's the main piece of legislation that's driving everything we do, in the UK at least. And I think Australia's got pretty much
same. I think Canada might be similar. I stand to be corrected. New Zealand certainly is. New Zealand's adopted WHS legislation from Australia, you know, broadly speaking. I mean, I find it's interesting. There's a high court decision over here called Slivak and Lurgy, and Justice Mary Gaudron says in that case, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but she says something to the effect that it's surprising how many times cases come before the High Court dealing with the term reasonably practicable. It's surprising because it's an ordinary term, you know, the meaning's plain on its own words, sort of thing. So from a legal perspective, that's where we sit. I think the difficulty with reasonably practicable in the way that it's interpreted by the health and safety industry, it's like, have we got the right control? And, you know, have we got enough barriers? Have we got enough training, whatever it might be? But in a very practical perspective, when you're talking about reasonably practicable, you're talking about two things. One is, do we have proper systems to manage the hazards in our business? And that will generally be measured, as you say, it'll be measured against codes of practice and standards and legislation. So, you know, most jurisdictions that have a Robin-style legislation, if there's a, you take working at heights, right, there'll be a code of practice for working at heights and it will describe what you have to do, and there'll be probably be regulations that say at certain heights, certain other things kick in, okay? And the measure is, do you have a system that aligns with those requirements? And the second part of it, and this is the bit that we always, this is the bit that the industry misses, is have we got adequate supervision to know if those systems are implemented and effective? And that's the bit, I think, where we miss out. Part of the reason why I think we miss out is because of this obsession to measure safety. So, so for example, injury rate data. All right. And the fact that we are still having a conversation about the relevance of injury rate data in 2022 says to me how far health and safety has got to go to really have credibility in some areas. Health and safety data, injury rate data, is not evidence that our systems are in place and effective. And that's the conversation we're not having. What is it that we need to do to understand if those systems are in place and if they work?
It's interesting. I remember, I don't want to repeat the conversation, and people can go to your conversation with David Provan on the safety work, because you spoke quite, I think it was David's podcast, you spoke quite heavily about supervision, but there was, what I thought was really insightful from that conversation, Greg, is kind of what you define as supervision. Like, because I think many of us in the UK, when we hear supervision, we automatically think somebody watching somebody. But you kind of described, if I interpreted and listened to you correctly, you described supervision as like the whole kind of system, like it, that acts as supervision. I don't know whether you could kind of reiterate that, I suppose.
I guess what I was trying to do, because the quote that I was giving came from a court case, and it talked about adequate supervision to make sure the systems are in place and effective. Okay. And the point of that really was to recognise that when the court uses the term supervision in that context, they're not talking about what supervisors do. They're talking, as you point out, whole of organisation oversight and assurance to know that the systems work. Now, what supervisors do is a really important part of that process, but that's not necessarily what the courts talk about when they say that. And it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned it before, James, when you said that a lot of what health and safety people do, particularly, and I think you're right, particularly entry-level safety people, they do get a lot of schooling in the regulations, and then they come in and they do see themselves as enforcers of the regulations.
Yeah.
And I think you actually have to educate yourself out of your safety education to become good at safety, as bizarre as that sounds.
Totally.
But the problem with it, and I've seen this before, safety people talking about safety legislation can talk to the technical regulatory requirements, but what they don't appreciate is all of the case law that unpicks and unravels the sorts of phrases that we talk about in safety. So reasonably practicable, foreseeable, control, influence, those sorts of of matters.
I would attest to that. It took me a long time to actually do my diploma over here, which is like degree level education, because I spat my dummy out and I'm too stubborn and I didn't want to do it. But I ended up doing the newer entry to the market, so to speak, over here in the NCRQ diploma, and pretty much a large, so you get like three books within that. Like book one is essentially like what I did in like the NEBOS general, like your entry level stuff, which we kind of went through and rehashed, which was all right. But it was all case study based, the whole thing. And then you moved into book two, which was all about insurance and legal and stuff like that. And that was all heavy legal case studies. And I remember opening the first page and kind of flicking through it and being like, shit, this is going to be heavy. Like, this is going to be, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Like, that sounds really weird, but I actually really enjoyed it. And I would say that second book alone probably gave me more insight into UK legislation than I think I've ever had in going through all of those different case studies and reading a case, you making a decision in your head. And I think how they designed the book was really good as well. But essentially, like, they force you to make a decision as to what, like, act like you're the judge, essentially. And then they tell you what the judge said, which was a really interesting way of learning. But ultimately, what was really nice was to read the case and think, oh, I think it probably, they should have gone to jail, or they should have been fined X amount, or definitely not innocent. And then reading that, like, the judge was like, actually, no, they were totally, like, this was just a normal hazard and the company could have done what they believed to be reasonable and practicable, was really insightful. And there's one particular case that they talk about that I'll probably never forget, where they got like an old quarry pit or something that had become like a public swimming pool, basically, or a paddling pool or whatever. And long story short, a young boy, I think, like, dived in head first into this pool, knowing that it was kind of like a paddling pool and not a swimming pool, kind of dived in, had a horrific injury. And they basically went through, and I remember the judge basically saying, and I would say I'm not even paraphrasing, I'm literally probably just vaguely remembering this. But ultimately it was like, you know, legislation shouldn't exist to kind of restrict enjoyment of like our natural environment. And the company shouldn't be forced to remove the hazards of our natural environment. It is what it is. And it was just a paddling pool. Like, they shouldn't have signs up saying this is just a pad, like, it's shallow, you can walk through the whole thing. It was something like that. And I remember reading that and thinking, wow, that's amazing. Whereas I think if I was a safety professional 5 years ago, 10 years ago for that company, I would read the legislation and go, right, I need to tell them that it's shallow. And the judge was like, no, they should know that it's shallow by going in.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was like, wow. So I think you've hit the nail on the head there, like, more exposure and critical thinking around case studies would be really, really beneficial to the safety profession.
I think it would help. I mean, there's an interesting sort of chain of case law in Australia, which I think would probably align pretty close with Canada and the UK, that sort of says you don't need to warn people or take precautions against obvious hazards which people would encounter in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
Okay, so that fell out of a case where a person was injured walking up the stairs, and the court basically said, well, you know, you don't have to warn people about the dangers of walking up and downstairs. The fact that it's in a workplace doesn't matter. I mean, that's a hazard they would associate in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
And there's another case called Prospect Electricity, which talks about this notion of the infinite regression of supervisors, having well-trained supervisors supervising well-trained supervisors who in turn are supervised by well-trained supervisors. And said, not necessary. And they made an interesting comment where they said, a well-trained tradesperson doesn't need to be taught or told to cross the road safely.
Mm.
And I thought, wow, you know, my initial experience, that's one of the first things that stood out when I first got involved in the oil and gas industry, was that actually that was a rule in the workplace, that when you left the office and went out for lunch, it was a rule that you crossed the street at lights and you didn't cross against the lights. And if you did and you got caught, your employment would be terminated. And you have all these signs in the workplace about, you know, water coming out of a hot water tap is hot and knives are sharp and And it's like, how do you get credibility as an industry to have people pay attention when you're talking about really important things if their day-to-day lives is just full of this flotsam and jetsam of nonsense and trivia?
I
struggled with it. I couldn't stay in that kind of work environment.
I think your book resonates with so many people, Greg. I think that what you've just hit there is a nail on the head. I think a lot of people that are safety professionals like myself and, you know, numerous people that were in the PM book club when we've just finished reading your book early in the new year. It resonates with so many of us in that I remember in an old job of mine, getting a phone call from my manager, and I still think she gave it to me because she knew that I was probably the one of few in the team that would kick up stink about having to do this. And whether she wanted that to happen or not, I don't know, but I had a phone call and it was like, Jane, can you just do a job for the head office? And I was like, head office is not my area. Why am I doing head office? I just wonder if you could just do a head office job. I'm like, all right, fine. Do I want you to kind of just do a policy or something around keeping your shoes on in the office? And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And they're like, yeah, can you just do that? Why? Well, because there's been a complaint that a lady has taken her shoes off. And I was like, right, what's that got to do with me? Like, what's that got to do with our department? Like, we're busy here trying to fix a lot of these buildings that are going to burn down if they catch on fire and people will go for a horrific death. What do you want me to deal with somebody standing on what, a staple? That's just normal life. Like, people take their shoes off at home. Well, yeah, but this is an office. There's loads of different people in there. I'm like, this is not our job. I talk to HR. This is a uniform issue, if anything.
Exactly right. It was somebody taking offence. But I mean, I think the point of, and I hope the point came through, the point of Paper Safe was this was not some bloke who doesn't like paperwork coming up with a theory about paperwork. Everything in every, there's not a lot of original thought in there. Here's everything from the court cases, which have, so everything that you as a safety person or you as a worker find infuriating or frustrating or disingenuous or whatever it is about the paperwork and the process that you have to deal with in safety, guess what? When it lands in front of the courts, they kind of have the same view. There's not this huge disconnect between them. And the thing I like pointing out to people most is not, here's some bullet points on a slide. Here is the page from the judgment where the judge uses the term tick and flick. All right. They will read your documents. They will listen to the witnesses and they know, for the same reason that we all know.
Do you think like judges are just fed up of reading this just the same shit and just going, why have people not got this? Like, I imagine they're just frustrated that they're not.
No, I don't think they turn their mind to it one way or the other. And as I say, they, your average judge, first of all, wouldn't deal with that many prosecutions, so they wouldn't be sitting, they wouldn't have a clue. Right. They wouldn't know what the fatality rates are. They wouldn't know what industry injury rates are. They wouldn't have a clue that organisations struggle with this stuff. It's not what they do.
Right. Just make a decision that in front
and
of
it's them. just one of the things that crosses their desk on a daily basis. So they've got a, our safety stuff's prosecuted most of it in the magistrates court. So they've got some guy from the local lockup who was fighting in the pub the night before, or they've got some drunk driver or some person who's had their license disqualified, and safety is just in that sausage factory of the lower tiers of the judicial system. Yeah. Nothing special about it.
No.
Most of it gets dealt with by way of a guilty plea.
Yeah.
You just churn it through, no learnings, no sharing of lessons. Advocates for this style of legislation like to talk about the deterrent effect, not seeing it personally.
No. No. Do you I was thinking when I was reading Paper Save, and then when I was listening to you talk to David Provan, David and I think Drew, they both did it together, I can't remember, but they did a paper on safety work, and like they broke kind of safety work and the work of safety into like different categories. So there's like the work that we do to demonstrate safety.
Yep.
So you understand, and I've spoken about it numerous times on a podcast, so I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. To me, when I read that, I thought that's probably one of the most important things I've read in a long time. Like, it really resonated with me, and I thought, you know, if we can get more safety professionals to think like this, in that, and the reason why I think that it was beneficial is because I think people can read like safety anarchists, and they can get really into all this new safety differently, whatever. To your point, maybe even read Paper Safe, misinterpret it and feel like the paperwork's delivering nothing, just get rid of all of it. And then, you know, and misinterpret this whole movement, so to speak, for lack of a better phrase, and not understand that what I think they demonstrate really well in that paper. And I do think you cover it really well in your book as well, in that the paper has a purpose. And sometimes that purpose is not managing impactfully the safety of the job. And sometimes you've just got to have this piece of paper. Like, I think in the UK, things like CHAZ, right? CHAZ is communicated, not just CHAZ, there are other brands, CHAZ, SMAS, whatever, some are better than others. But ultimately, they have no connection to impactful safety on the shop floor. They don't make the workplace safer, in my opinion, at all. They are your classic tick and flick, right? However, you're required to have them to get on site.
Yep.
So and they may be, if somebody doesn't have CHAZ, it might be a slight indication that the person doesn't know anything. And there might be a little bit of a signal there to say, there's something we need to, you know, have a conversation about, because you're not even doing this stuff. And that's a bit tick and flick. So for me, it's kind of like, sometimes we just need to understand that there are stuff that we do that is really impactful on safety. And that's obviously our priority, but also there's going to be some stuff that we do that's not impactful, but we still need to do it for the wider context of running a business. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
There's so much in that. I mean, I can unpack that all night. So there's a couple of things. First of all, I think, and this is when I talk about the safety paradox, I guess, is that most of the processes that we develop for safety have at least some theoretical basis, which on an uneducated view might make a positive contribution towards safety.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, some sort of pre-task risk assessment, for example. So the theoretical basis for it is there. Now, I'll qualify this guy. I'm not a sociologist and I'm not a form designer. So there are probably some documents and processes that are just inherently bad. Yeah. But the mere fact that we've designed them and they look like this way probably creates a problem in and of itself. I'll leave that to the sociologists and the psychologists and the design engineers. Okay, I don't understand that. But let's assume most of what we do has some sort of theoretical basis that sounds right to us. Oh, yes, if somebody has a checklist and they go through the checklist before they start work, that should probably make a positive contribution to safety. Right. My, and I'm not saying this is the only experience of it, but my experience of it, and this is what I wrote about, is that we get a disconnect between purpose and process.
Yeah.
So if the purpose of the checklist is to make sure that the site I'm just about to do some work on is properly set up and safe, that's fine if the form is achieving that outcome.
Yeah.
But what often happens with so many of our processes is that the purpose becomes the completion of the process itself, not the outcome the process was designed to achieve.
Yes.
So the purpose of me filling out a form is to show that I've got a completed form.
Yeah.
Which may or may not contribute to safety depending on how well I've done it.
Yeah.
Then we bump into the assurance piece that I talked, you know, we talked about supervision and assurance before.
Yep.
So if this process that you've defined in your organisation and you've said it's important and you, James, as a worker, you must do this every time before you start work, how much time, effort and energy is your organisation prepared to put in to understand if that's being done properly and is working? Because if all you're doing is say, do it, and we're never going to check the quality or the efficacy of it, why have it?
Yeah.
Because potentially all you are doing is building a database of non-compliance.
Mm-hmm.
All these forms are being completed and collected and collated and counted and stuck into a database somewhere. No one's looking at them.
Mm.
They all look like crap. They all look like tick and flick documents. Then you've got two dead bodies on the ground and the regulator says, oh, what's in this database over here? Yeah. Oh, look, this hazard's been identified 134 times in the last 2 years. What have you done about it? Oh, shit, didn't even know it was there.
Yeah.
That's the frustration I get.
Yeah, and I took that from the book as well, like that, what's the purpose? Like, I think if we combine, for me, this is how I've kind of used it. I've combined that purpose and process conversation with the kind of safety of work and worker safety.
Yes.
I think those just so work so well together in my, as a practitioner, in my kind of opinion. And what's our purpose with this? This job, what are we trying to achieve? If I'm brutally honest, this is just about showing something to our insurers. Okay, cool. That's our process. That's what we're trying to do. So let's make sure we achieve that and let's do that. Okay, what's our purpose today? Our purpose today is to make this job safer. Okay, that's what we're trying to achieve then, not satisfy insurers. We might satisfy insurers by doing this anyway, but ultimately, yeah. Like, I think back to, I use a forklift truck example so many times in that if I was trying to do my forklift truck checklist, pre-checklist thing that I had this massive issue with getting these drivers to do it years and years and years ago, the first thing I'd do now is just get rid of the checklist. I'll just get rid of the checklist because The purpose is doing the check and they know what to check. They all knew what to check, but we've took what was a 30-second to a minute job to now being a 5 to 10 minute job because they've got to fill the form out, take the form out, take it over to the box, put it in a box, like just get rid of the form. But that wouldn't maybe be very good to demonstrative safety. So we'll find another way to demonstrate it because our purpose right now is to check the forklift truck.
Yeah. And it's interesting because this idea of, and again, insurance and lawyers and consultants probably to blame here, but this idea of evidencing that we do these things is probably what drives it. I've lost count of how many times I've suggested instead of having a checklist approach to pre-start inspections where you're creating these masses of paperwork, why not just have a by exception reporting?
Yeah.
If there's a problem, report it. Yeah. I mean, as an exercise in theory, it achieves exactly the same outcome.
Yeah.
From a safety perspective, what it doesn't achieve is a piece of paper that says it's been done. Now, the piece of paper doesn't say the job's been done. What the piece of paper says is the piece of paper's been completed.
Yeah.
Everything else is an assumption.
Yeah.
But the other problem with this idea of evidencing safety, and again, I'm probably going to sound like a complete wanker when I say this, and I don't mean to, but the people who we are entrusting with evidencing our safety process never went to school to complete paperwork and forms.
Mm-hmm.
They love driving trucks and swinging spanners and whatever it is, and they're really good at it, and they do, you know, they do stuff I can't do.
Yeah.
I can evidence safety for you really well.
Yeah.
Or I can write it down, and I can be clear and precise and articulate and make sure that what's written on the piece of paper will stand up in court.
Yeah.
Your workforce can't.
Yes.
Right? They're not trained to. They don't understand it. For them, they just need to get the bit of paper done so they can get on with the job. And even, and I, again, I'm not being critical, even if they do it with the best will in the world to try and understand the risks and properly articulate and document that, 95% of the time what they write is rubbish.
Yeah.
Because that's not their job. That's not what they're good at. We don't train them to do it, right? We don't give them any help how to do it. And, you know, how many inductions have you been in where the so-called instructor stands up the front of the room and says, right, you blokes have all done a pre-start inspection before. I don't need to tell you about that, do I? Yeah, no, good, right, next topic.
It's so true. It's so true. I mean, that, I think a lot of people will listen to that, Greg, and be nodding their heads, whether they're driving right now or whatever. They'll be like, yeah, you know, same as I am. I'm like, yes, you're so right. But how do, yeah, but how do they do that? Like, how do they change that? Because it's like trying to change something that's like kind of tattooed on our body. Do you know what I mean? Like, that literally defines so many people's jobs. It's like, that's just how we manage risk. We create a piece of paperwork, we lovely template, and we do think about the shop floor employee and how to make it easier for them. But they need to demonstrate it. And I think people really struggle with that. And this comes back to what we started our conversation with, doesn't it? Is what does this look like in reality? And that's really hard. And is it that the evidencing needs to be done more by that safety department? And then so that demonstrated. So does the safety department become like, imagine you've got a massive company, right? Huge resource, loads of money, big safety team. Is that safety team split into like you're just auditors and assurance team, and your job is to literally convert, as you've just said, go down to the shop floor, look what they're doing, look at the presence of safety, as Eric would call it, and convert that into something that we can demonstrate out without hindering the span of swingers on the shop floor?
Yep. If I was a company officer in Australia at the moment in a high-risk industry facing the threats of a prosecution for industrial manslaughter, I would repurpose my safety team to be responsible for that.
Yeah, really.
I think that's what I would be doing. But, again, there's no one-size-fits-all answer for this, because different workforces, different levels of sophistication, different resources, different staffing, all of that stuff is a real issue. It's a real limitation. It's a real problem for a lot of organisations. But I think the start point is, first of all, understanding what processes do you actually have in your organisation. Now, I know that sounds a bit silly, but particularly in larger organisations, this stuff has been getting layered and layered and layered over so many years. A lot of people wouldn't even understand the number of processes they have in their organisation, or the checklists or forms or whatever it might be. So the start point is probably to understand, well, what do we have? And then there's a conversation that says, and I'm wearing a lawyer's hat now, but, you know, okay, what's the bare minimum we need? Do we need this form? No. Do we need that form? Yes. Regulation 427 says we need that. All right, well, that stays for starters. All right, so here's all the stuff that we must have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then the next layer is, okay, over and above that, what do we really think we need that's going to deliver a safety outcome?
Yeah.
And I think if you get your conversation to that point with a willingness to say, we are now going to expend the time and effort to understand that these processes are done properly. That's, in my view, probably more value than producing lots and lots of processes that aren't done properly.
Mm.
I think that conversation of like, what do we legally need with maybe like UK legislation would actually be a really difficult conversation. In that, you know, I was just talking about Kosh the other day, right? And it, you know, this company had like, and this is not uncommon. I think everyone's had it, like Kosh assessments, yep, for household chemicals, Kosh assessments for boot polish, Kosh assessments for fairy washing up liquid. And it's like, but that's just normal household chemicals. Because the regulation says you must have a Kosh assessment for hazardous chemicals. And in theory, there is a hazardous chemical. So it's like just having that, to what do we need, is actually a really difficult conversation. Like it says you must have assessed the risk of essentially anything that's going to hurt someone in your workplace. Have you got more than 5 employees, write it down. I think it's a little bit better with the more general risk assessment, the management of health and safety at work makes it clear, like record the significant findings. But then things like Kosh, I might be wrong and I'm happy to be corrected on that. I don't think it's that specific in the Kosh reg. So you do end up going in and seeing just a Kosh assessment for everything. And I know we're going uber specific here, but it's just one example. And you're like, well, fuck me, I haven't got a Kosh assessment for washing up liquid downstairs. And I've got an 18-month-old baby running around the house drinking everything. So it is a really conversation, really difficult process to go through. Like, what do we actually legally need? Is that point where, would it be, do you think, beneficial to, for a company at that point to, like, I'll frame this question another way. Are safety professionals truly competent to interpret the legislation that well?
I think by and large, when we're talking about regulations, yes, because they deal with, my experience of regulations, they deal with technical topics, which, you know, you can get guidance on and you can get advice on and deal with the technical topics. I think in that sense they are.
Yeah.
The question is, who sets the risk appetite for the organisation?
Mm.
Okay, so if you've got to have an assessment for washing up liquid, what are the consequences of not having that assessment?
Yeah.
All right. Now, okay, is somebody going to go and start mixing washing up liquid with their shots of tequila at work and kill themselves? God knows. And if they did, well, seriously, I think you could run a reasonable defence against that.
Yeah.
The question becomes, how much time, effort and energy are your safety resources expending on the management of that issue as opposed to being out in your workplace making sure people are not losing arms or falling off balconies?
Yeah, yeah.
And, again, I think, I don't know, I mean, there's a few things. I am probably going to get vilified here, but let's see where we go. One of the things that strikes me about my observations of safety and health over the last 30 years is that there does seem to be an inherent laziness in the preparedness to do the work to manage health and safety. I mean, I'll give an example. You know, the fact that people would go and do ongoing, you know, I think you can mount an argument and say you don't need to go and do risk assessments of household washing up liquid, yep, in your workplace.
Yep.
But I think for lots of health and safety people, they would prefer to be doing that than having a difficult conversation with a work group in the workplace.
I see where you're going. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think the reason why we have so much emphasis on personal injury rates in the health and safety industry is it's easy to do.
I agree with that. Feel like they're having an impact though, don't you? Like you feel like you're doing something, maybe.
I don't know.
Or both, probably both, to be fair. Yeah, I agree. I think whether it's a point that the safety profession and businesses are just drowning in stuff like that and they want to do something else, maybe that's some of them. Maybe some of them are nice and comfortable in the feeling of doing a cost assessment for boat polish, you know, or whatever.
Yep. And I think there are a lot of safety people who are really very comfortable and quite happy, despite the protestations that you hear, I don't get to spend enough time in the field. I think a lot of them are quite happy sitting in an office behind a computer amending documents,
yeah,
or updating databases and doing reports. Now, I'm probably being unkind to an enormous number of people in the industry, but when you think of all of the stuff that you're being critical of tonight, the sort of stuff that you've read and you're repeating back to us and talking about that you're critical of, somewhere it's the health and safety industry that has to take responsibility for that.
Yes.
And surely we are the ones who are responsible to stand up in front of the boardrooms or to stand up in front of CEOs or wherever we have our voice in the organisation and say, this is what you ought to be doing.
Mate.
And we should have an industry united behind us to say, yes, that is what you should be doing, instead of so many conflicting messages about what safety looks like.
I absolutely love what you've just said. I not so long ago, I think last year, mid to late last year, put a post on LinkedIn saying exactly the same thing, in that I think the HSC had just put out their fatality stats, right? And I was like, if we really and truly care about getting this number down, which has been flat for a decade now, you know, on average in the UK, it's still 140 something deaths nearly every year for a decade. We ourselves have to take some accountability and turn around, and what we are doing as a profession is not working. It hasn't changed. Nothing is improving. And I got like vilified, like literally thought I was going to have people with pitchforks outside my house. Like I was having messages and everything. And all of them consistently said the same thing. We're just here to advise, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but it's our advice that's not making a difference. So we have to take accountability. And I find it so ironic that a profession that is bread and butter is pushing accountability onto the company and saying, you must be accountable, Mr. or Mrs. CEO of this company, for safety. You must be responsible. Refuses to take any accountability for just having no impact anymore, in my opinion. And I think we will be getting witch hunted after this, Greg, if I'm honest. Oh, I've lost your audio. You've gone quiet. You're not muted. Oh, no. Oh, your blue light's gone off. So maybe your battery's run out.
Can you hear me now?
Yep, I got you. You got your call center headset on.
Yeah, sorry about that. I ran a 2-hour workshop this morning, so I've obviously flattened out.
They're good bits of kit, though, those Rode wireless goes. They're nice.
They're very good. Yeah, I just did a video series, and they're really good for that.
I've never set it up for the computer call, though. That's quite clever.
Yeah, I like it. Now I'm going to have to charge that up. That's all right. Now, what was the last thing I said? Oh, yeah, we're going to get vilified. I was saying they'll have to join the line and come around the corner. Think about it this way. So if you're the chief executive officer of an organization, okay, you've got responsibility for a whole range of things. How does a chief executive officer get informed about the financial performance of the company?
By the finance department.
Yeah, they've got a chief financial officer, they've got an accountant. They get informed by HR. I mean, ultimately, the CEO makes decisions. But, you know, and I was having this conversation with a safety professional the other day, and I said, if you are going to hold a chief executive officer liable for not exercising due diligence in relation to the health and safety obligations of the organisation, surely the health and safety inspectors are going to be having a serious conversation with the senior health and safety advisors to say, what did you tell the CEO?
Mm.
What information did you give them? And I do think it's an industry that has rested for too long on all care and no responsibility.
Mm. Yeah.
Because, you know, if the CEO is relying on injury statistics as evidence of due diligence, and the health and safety advisor has never told them that that is not a measure of safety in your organisation, where's the accountability of the health and safety person in those circumstances?
Mate, I love where this is going. I wish we went down this rabbit hole an hour ago. It's so
just edit it and swap this around at the front.
Yeah. It's so true that do we not have an obligation to, when we hear something like, I mean, I use these examples all the time, but the HSC has put out a report to say, we don't think the kind of back to school manual handling training approach is effective. Evidence has shown that it doesn't have any impact on improving technique. We have an obligation to report that back to our board and say, I think we might need to stop spending money on all this manual handling training and rethink about where we're going. And again, not just the safety profession, also the health and safety executive, because I put that exact question to one of their enforcing officers and said, your science division has said this. What do we do with that? Because I've not seen anything else off the back of it. And I was the head of safety for a trade association. And so it was our job to tell our members about that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do I tell our members? And she was like, well, if we turned up and you weren't doing any manual handling training, we would enforce. And I'm like, okay, I'm not really sure where to go with that, in that I'm not saying remove everything. What I'm saying is your piece of science that you have given us has said, we don't think it's having an impact on delivering safety. What do you want us to do with that? And she won't give me an answer.
Yeah.
And the profession hasn't done anything with it. Our professional body hasn't done anything with it. There's no evidence to say high visibility clothing is increases visibility. Yet high visibility clothing is bread and butter in the safety profession. Yeah. You could go on all day. And to your point, you know, the statistic invalidity of accident, yep, incident data has been questioned for numerous years now, yet it's all we talk about. And I think we have some accountability in that 100%. I agree with you. Is that not what our job is?
I would have thought so. And that's not to say, and look, I give advice, it's my job, and not all of my advice is acted on, and not all of my advice is welcome, and that's fine. And I'm not saying, and I think safety people get a bit down in the mouth around this. I think, oh, I can't influence and whatever. And we there's this big, almost this whole other industry that hangs off health and safety about how to influence, and we send people off and do influence. And yeah, influence is important, and we want all of that. But it's also perfectly okay if you want to hold yourself out as a professional to provide professional advice based on facts and statistics and research or whatever it is. Here is my advice to you.
Yeah.
And if they say, thank you for your advice, Greg, but we want to do something else.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Can I suggest you do it this way? No, we want to do it that way. Okay, well, if that's what you want to do, I've given you my advice and I'm prepared to support what you're asking me to do. And then we deal with it that way.
Yeah.
But I'm just not sure we are. And you know, there will be exceptions to these rules, and you're right, I'll be told that I'm wrong, but that's fine. I'm just not sure we're particularly accountable as an industry for safety.
Yeah,
it seems to be everybody else's fault except safety.
Yeah. And I do think there is, you know, that story of the ladies are always passing away after childbirth, you know, years and years and years, you know, hundreds of years ago. And they couldn't work out what it was and why they were, I can't remember the particular case. And a doctor or a young student doctor or something like that worked out that it was because in the mornings they were doing autopsies to try and work out what the problem was. And then they were delivering. They were delivering in the afternoon. So they were basically infecting the ladies and killing them because they weren't washing their hands. And a doctor had worked it out and said, it's you're the problem. Like, even though you're trying to fix the problem, you're the problem. Your hygiene is not up to scratch. And the concept of virus and bacteria didn't exist really back then. And I feel like that's where we are as a safety profession, is that, yes, a lot of us are doing some amazing work. And yes, for years since, like, you know, in the UK, since 1974, we have done some phenomenal work in partnership with businesses, in partnership with the enforcing agency. And we're not saying that is, you know, doesn't exist. It's a hat tip to that's what we've done. But this is where we are now. We're not having an impact. And I think at least in part, we are the problem. I think it's kind of like going to an Alcoholics Anonymous group, isn't it? Like, we need to accept that first. Once we accept the problem, we might actually be able to move forward with this. But that's a really difficult conversation for us to have.
Well, at least isn't it beholden on us to ask the question, you know, could we be part of the problem?
Yeah. Yeah,
and see where that takes us.
Yeah, or even if you're not comfortable having that conversation with yourself, come back to what you talk about in your book and what you spoke about several times today. What's the purpose of what we're doing here, and are we achieving that purpose? Like, critically ask yourself. Go pick up one of your risk assessments for you, one of your high risk tasks, and go, what's the purpose of this? And your answer will probably be to make the job safer. Is it achieving that? And if your answer is no, could Bob never follows the rules, then you need to have a really serious conversation with yourself.
Yeah. And you can ask that. You can ask that question at all levels. I mean, it's amazing, for example, how many major accident inquiries will. And it's just tragic that it takes a major accident inquiry. But you have a major accident inquiry, and it's interesting how much of the blame also gets laid at the feet of the regulator.
Mm.
Okay. And so there's more than one moving part in all of this. Mm. And the health and safety, and, you know, and when I talk about the health and safety industry, I'm not just talking about individual practitioners. Okay. So, you know, we've got a body over here, Australian Institute of Health and Safety. I'm not a member. I don't see much value, I'll be honest, in health and safety professional organisations. I'm not sure, honestly, what they offer. They seem to do some good stuff. They have some good speakers. There's some very good people who are a part of it. So it's not a criticism. There's some really good individuals who are part of it. But I don't know what they stand for as an organisation, for example. And when... My overwhelming sense was when industrial manslaughter started to sweep through Australia, this was a professional body that was in favour of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence that it's going to improve safety outcomes.
Mm.
And I really just think that it's beholden on organisations like that to be the voice of the industry,
yeah,
present the evidence, and form a view about it, not just say, oh, the government's introduced this, we need to do something. Form a view about it and say, is this a good thing or not? Give the industry something it can hang its hat on,
yeah,
and work with.
Yeah. I think we have the exact same problem. And I think those bodies might come back and say, actually, no, we do lobby government or whatever. But like when I worked for a trade association, that was literally our job. Like, all the time, anything the government was doing, whether it was funding or a campaign or legislation change, whatever, we would get inundated from our members being like, we need you to say this, we need you to say that. And our job was to collate all of these opinions and be the voice for that particular trade. I don't feel like our professional bodies in safety do that at all.
Yeah. And look, they may not see that as their role. I don't know. But again, I circle back around a bit on this point. You talk about industry divided. And, you know, we have a thing called the body of knowledge here in Australia that's designed to sort of underpin safety. And there's a few things like that. But when it comes to some really core principles around how to effectively manage health and safety in organisations, I don't see much in the way of consistent messaging or constant, you know, some sort of solid basis that you can say this is the appropriate thing to be doing.
The other problem we have within it is in, like, ultimately those types of organizations are made up of people of that profession or industry. And if the issue is criticism of that profession or industry, then ultimately that body's never going to say we screwed up. So I think to the fire industry now in the UK, like, every fire professional or safety professional that has dealt with fire safety in those higher risk industries like sleeping risk, housing, hospitals and stuff like that would have said, yeah, we knew something was going to happen. We don't know. We weren't as clever to say it would be cladding and on a housing building, but ultimately we knew something was going to happen because the quality of work within our profession of risk management for fire was so inconsistent. It was all over the place. And the majority of them, in my opinion, were shite. And I've said that many a time, the majority of fire risk assessments still, even now, that I read are so far away from what the legislation actually requires us to do, what building regs actually requires it. And there's some context to that because building regs is messy AF and it's really screwed up. And the government, they take some accountability there on fixing that. But ultimately, I was damned lucky to have two amazing mentors that got this stuff. So, you know, I didn't just wake up enlightened. I was really lucky to kind of have the insight from them. But ultimately, I look at so many fire risk assessments now and I go, we're the problem. And I don't think you'll ever see the IFE, the Institute of Fire Safety Managers, maybe not ever, is probably not the right way to say it. I think that the messaging might be influenced by some of the people that are just profiting from those really easy copy and paste fire risk assessments, those crappy training sessions that deliver no value or whatever it is, you know, just one example. But ultimately, these bodies are really good things. And I've been in one and seen how powerful it can be. But ultimately, it's made up of people that might also be profiting from the... We're in muddy waters now.
Greg. Oh, no. There's a lot of snake oil sold in safety. And, you know, a lot of medium-sized businesses are pretty easy prey to sell a safety product to. And I know this all sounds down and miserable. I mean, you know, we have to acknowledge in some areas of safety, so, you know, the traumatic physical harm in safety, there have been enormous improvements over the last 20 years. That's true. There have been other areas where I think we've actually gotten worse. You know, psychosocial harm in workplaces has gotten worse.
Yeah.
So there's been tremendous improvements. Some of the ground rules are shifting. That's all true. There are also some absolutely brilliant, outstanding individuals in safety. I mean, I look at the blood, sweat, and tears that some people I have to deal with put into safety, and what they do is tremendous, and it's excellent, and it's really, really wonderful.
Yeah.
But anybody who stands on the outside looking in must wonder what is going on. I can't get a consistent message. The quality of documentation that I see, and again, granted, quality of documentation I see is really ordinary most of the time. And I'm talking about incident investigations, risk assessments, the quality of drafting in policies and procedures. It's poor. Very often it's really poor. And to your point before, James, it is really inconsistent.
Yeah.
It's really inconsistent. I shouldn't be overly critical about that. I mean, you could probably say the same about the legal profession. You know, the quality of advice can be really poor in some areas, and you know, there are lawyers who work outside of their areas of expertise. And you know, every profession, every industry has its high points and its low points.
Yeah.
But it does strike me that safety's pretty stagnant, I think, at the moment. Where there's not a lot of innovation. There's not a lot of courage. Even the new view of safety, by the time it gets to the shop floor, really does it look that much different in most cases? There's probably one or two pockets of excellence I've seen them. I know there's some practitioners who are doing really good stuff in really sort of discrete areas, but it's a struggle, I think.
I think there is. I mean, it's interesting. I had this conversation. We're gonna have to nip this in the bud in a minute, mate.
No, sure.
You're probably going to go to bed, and I've got loads of work to do. I was having this conversation with a gentleman over here. He ran an event for us actually at Project at PM, and he's a particularly big voice within the kind of safety differently kind of world, in that he is just doing it right, just out there. One company done it, worked it for that company, saw what it looked like for him, gone to the next company to just play around with it, and he's just doing it right. He's not on LinkedIn, he's not on podcasts, he's not on anything, he's just doing shit, right?
Yeah.
And we ended up having this really interesting conversation after this little event with him, the week later with the rest of the community. And I said, look, it's really interesting, this conversation, and that we need to hear more from the people that are just doing it, because at the moment all we've got is academics bickering at the top, which is what academics are supposed to do. We want them to do it, to challenge each other and do that, but leave them up there to do that. We'll just read their books and interpret it however we want. But we also need practitioners coming out and saying, this is how we've done this. This is where it did work. This is what it didn't work, blah, blah, blah. And then someone else saying, actually, we did this and it did work here and that didn't work there, or whatever, right? And they were like, no, we've too many people on LinkedIn, too many people with their opinions and stuff like this. And all the people doing good stuff are just doing it. And I'm like, but that's also part of the problem, in that we need to hear from those people just doing it, because that's what we need. Like, everyone's going, oh, you know, we need to hear more about Sydney, needs to tell us about how to do this. No, Sydney doesn't need to tell us that. The practitioners need to tell us that. I don't want to hear from, no offense to their new book, this is not a targeted criticism because I haven't read it, but I don't really want to hear from Sydney and Todd about how to do safety differently, because they're academics, in my opinion. But I want to hear from the Bobs and the Charlies and the Sheilas on the shop floor that are just doing it.
Yeah.
Does that look
like? Yeah, and they haven't got employers who have forked out an enormous sum of money to get two really competent academics in to run a trial in their business.
Their old mate
who's gone and knocked on the factory owner's door and said, mate, can I have a crack at this?
Yeah, yeah, and that's a really good point. Like, if you're getting Sydney in or Todd in, you're invested in it, right? That's a shit, because that's costing you a shitload of money. But if you've just got like James from Wellingborough to come in, like, it's probably pretty cheap, and I'm going to have a fucking way harder battle to try and convince these people who have a better way to do things than Sydney would at NHS or Todd would at oil and gas, whatever. That's a really good point, actually, Greg, really good point. And they're the people I want to listen to. So, yes, they're busy. Yes, I don't really want another book, but I do want to hear from those people. Want them putting it on LinkedIn, put it on Facebook, whatever. Just do a little video or something. Like, tell us, we just tried to implement X and it was shite. It didn't work. Or we tried to implement X and it worked really well. But then we did the same thing at another company and turns out it's not copy and paste. It was really hard.
Yeah.
So they're the kind of conversations we need to hear more of. So I think going back to the accountability on us as a profession, we need to be more open with talking about, you know, publicly saying, here's where it went well, here's where it went wrong as well. And we have a duty to do that, I think, as well. Wow. Right, mate. We've been going on a very long time. I don't think, you know, all those notes that we made, I don't think we touched.
We touched any of them,
which is, I love that. I'm totally okay with that. Some of the best conversations are not with any notes or anything. That was really good. So thank you very much for that, Greg. And thank you for your time.
You've got a lot of editing to do.
Now, we don't edit any of this. We just put it out. most of my audience is in the UK, but we do have some around the world, and you're based in Australia. But, you know, in case there is anything that anyone would like to talk to you about or do some work with you, can they, how do they, so on. And obviously give a shout out to your books as well, please, Greg.
My website, waylandlegal.com.au. That's the easiest way to find me.
Grand.
And all the books are on there and the videos and anything else you want. If there is anybody left who wants to talk to me after this conversation, James.
And you're not allowed to bring a pitchfork.
No.
Greg, thank you very much. Put your website in the description as well. But thank you for your time, mate. That was really good.
Thanks, mate. Take care, James.
Okay, peeps. Hope you enjoyed that chat with Greg. He's a great guy. In general, most Aussies are really quite relaxed, easy to chat to. But ultimately, it's got a great kind of insight. And I think a lot of that comes from that mixture of having an insight into like the legal profession, but then also that practitioner side of things. So really, I really like that he kind of did that. And I think that's given him a real unique insight. As I said before, if you haven't read the book Paper Safe, then you definitely need to. I suspect you're going to want to after listening to Greg today anyway. But we'll link the book in the description below. It'll be an affiliate link, FYI, so we'll get like 2 pence if you do order it through there. And we actually get kind of 2 pence for everything that you order. So if you want to do your weekly shop or if fancy buying yourself like another 50-inch TV whilst you're there and get the book as well, you know, just fill the basket. Fill the basket, get everything, do your Christmas shopping now, be prepared, do all of your Christmas shopping through that link. Thank you. Don't forget to check out riskfluentlimited.com, where we can offer you support with technical and transformational cyber safety. But ultimately, I hope you've enjoyed this chat. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.